Coming up next, it's Prairie Public Presents, when we play programs that don't fit into our usual weekly, monthly schedules. These are one of a kinds normally, and today, something really special. On Prairie Public Presents, we often have stories from around the world, around the nation. This time, it's a fabulous story from right here in our own region.
Hi, I'm Matt Olean, the producer of Prairie Public's new documentary, Basketball, Water, and the Lost City of Elbowoods. This is a fascinating documentary about the town of Elbowoods, which is south of Newtown, and that town no longer exists. It's also about the 1942 high school basketball team from Elbowoods that was involved in a controversy in the state championship game that year. The documentary is in three sections. The first section covers the 1942 season. In this section, you will hear voices of children of the players. There are no players on that team still living, but their children are heard in this documentary. We will also hear from Mark Fox, the Three Affiliated Tribes chairman, former North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan, Dale Brown, who grew up in Minot and later became the Louisiana State University basketball coach, Scott Davis, the executive director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, Marilyn Hudson, who is the unofficial Three Affiliated Tribes historian and who was in the last graduating class at Elbowoods High School in 1953. And you'll also hear from two residents of Lakota, which was the team that defeated Elbowoods in the 1942 title game.
Elbowoods High School, 1942 State Class B champion.
I think the Elbowoods team was a team that was about 20 or 30 years ahead of its time.
Because Elbowoods is a really tight-knit community, and it was like Camelot. It could have been a dynasty for so many things, and it was just taken away with the building of the Gerson Dam.
In a way, it's kind of a haunted landscape, a very radical change that has occurred in that landscape. It's just a whole lot different than it was.
Funding for Basketball, Water, and the Lost City of Elbowoods is made possible by the Three Affiliated Tribes, Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nations, celebrating our tradition of resilience, strength, and power, and by the members of Prairie Public.
He was very proud of the story that took place, and at that young age, he was very proud that they made it to state as Native Americans and that the ball playing was very top-notch.
If memory serves me right, it was like 15 cents or something to get in the game. Well, we were poor, didn't have 15 cents. I wanted to get in. I found a bathroom window partially open. I climbed through the bathroom window and got myself a spot to watch them. And the first thing I remember, they seemed like men really compared to the team that beat them. And they were good, athletes. My biggest memory of the game, they could run forever.
The story of the 1941-42 Elbowoods North Dakota High School basketball team begins in the fall of 1941, prior to America's involvement in World War II. Their story might now be largely forgotten, except for a bizarre twist in the 1942 state championship game, coupled with the tragic aspect of what eventually happened to this small town on the Fort Berthold Reservation. The story you're about to see is one of loss and victory and 60 years of struggle and perseverance. A time when people believed in honesty, a time when perhaps people showed their feelings less freely, but felt them no less deeply.
The town was named Elbow Woods, which makes a lot of sense. It's a visual thing, an elbow in the woods. And the Missouri River in that location flowed southward from like what's now Williston. So the Missouri River was flowing southward, and then it makes that bend and goes eastward. And in that bend of the river then is where the community of Elbow Woods was established. The population probably would have been maybe 200. Well, the town of Elba Woods, really, I think the best classification would be an Indian agency was there, and that was sort of the hub. But it was not incorporated as such in that we did not have a mayor or a city council or anything like that. It was totally government.
My father lost his parents at a very, very early age, and as a young boy, he, among other things, herded horses on the reservation.
Former North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan.
He went up to the Indian reservation and got a job, and from that he loved horses all of his life. But in the process of doing that, later in life, he said to me, I want to take you back up to see the friends I have on the Indian reservation. And we drove to the Fort Berthold reservation, and we drove into Elba Woods, North Dakota. And I have memories of it as a young boy driving into this little town about the same size as my hometown of Regent, North Dakota, several hundred people. It was quiet, pretty little community.
We were the first farmers of North Dakota. Squash, corn, beans, watermelon, a number of crops, and we grew them in the fertile bottomlands.
I've seen pictures of Elba Woods, but I know they had a clinic, they had a main street, they had stores, and our grandparents lived around the surrounding area of Elba Woods. They didn't have diabetes, everything was there, like coal to heat their house, and they grew their own gardens, they hunted, deer was plentiful.
You know, things were good, the economy was good, people were happy, you know. And people were lawful, you know. To me, it was like heaven.
Leon Wall, I think, deserves just a lot of attention because here's a young man, 27 years old, that they came to Elba Woods from Washington, D.C., although he was a native Oklahoman. And he comes into Elba Woods to the agency headquarters and reports in because he's a federal employee now and he's going to teach what he thought was math and science.
Three Affiliated Tribes historian, Marilyn Hudson.
And so when he and his wife arrive there, the principal says, okay, yep, you are our teacher. I think school had already started. It was probably September by the time he got here. School started early September. And so he said, well, not only will you teach math and science, but you're also going to be the coach for our athletic team. And although he's only 27 years old, he was able to combine, you know, all of these skills of these nine players that he had. And he soon recognized that, you know, they possessed some unusual qualities. There's something special about these guys, you know.
We were to live in one of the new dormitories. We were conducted to our apartment, which was as nice as could be found in the Waldorf Astoria, we said. There was one exception. All cooking was to be done in the student kitchen. Our meals were to be taken with the students. In fact, we were to conduct the dormitory as though we were the mother and father, and the students were the children, in a home of 20 children.
You get this young man and his wife going way out to a little tiny reservation, coming from the East Coast, and saying, they're going to make a difference out there and teach and work with Indian children. And the coach brought some new ideas about how that game should be played.
Many odds against them. No money. A little tiny gym to practice in. Very little support from the community because the community could not go to these games. I mean, those were during World War II years. People just couldn't travel. Very few people even had a car.
Leon Wall began coaching the Warriors right away. He would later comment that the Elba Woods gym was so small, the free throw circle intersected the retaining circle at center of court. The only room for fans was on the stage for a small strip, less than 1 yard wide around the edge of the gym. Three Affiliated Tribes chairman, Mark Fox.
Camaraderie, there's a lot. They played as a team. And I looked over the stats and numbers.
Sidney, although he was a freshman, my dad's younger brother, was obviously, arguably, somebody would say, but I will say this, probably had the most talent. So my dad was the captain of the team, the leader being a senior. The other two players of great note was Mr. Charlie Blake. And Harry Grady, I see the stats where he had some games and he scored a lot of baskets. But the one that really stood out was considered very, very good, great basketball player was Johnny Rabbithead.
Those Indians just about turned the gym inside out, with Isaac Fox and Johnny Rabbithead holding the ball in one hand and waving it in front of a trooper's face, daring him to try to take it away. With Sidney Fox's one-handed hook shots while fading away from the basket, Charlie Blake's work on rebounds and dribbling, and the all-around passing and shooting of the team as a whole, it was a show.
Oh, I know that he played. He was one of the guards or forwards, and he said, you know what? I scored 10 points in that game. I said, oh, did you? And at the time, I didn't think it was a big deal until I started going to basketball tournaments. And I started coaching at different schools throughout the state.
Back in those days, the floor of the gym was, you know, with what they had at the time. And I guess you might as well say Cracker Jack box floor. But my dad, he had, a good shot, a famous shot. So they called him Johnny off the radiator. So he would, jump up in one motion, jump off the radiator and shoot all in one motion. And that was his signature shot. So he was pretty famous for that shot back in the days for the Warriors.
My uncle told me about that. They were fast, you know. They had a couple tall players, you know, but they were faster than the other teams. And my uncle, in his high school, he was a 100-yard dash champ, too, for McLean County, you know. So he was real fast, you know, at the time. So they had a real fast moving team.
He was center and forward, and he played mostly the forward, I believe. And this was right before World War II. So there was quite a bit of stir going on, and the Elbow Woods Warriors at that time in the state of North Dakota was one of those big events going on for a championship game.
Sidney was well built. Sidney had a really good perspective of the game. Some people are just physical. He had them both, physical and mental. And I thought he was one of the best high school players I'd seen at that time.
He was one of the younger players on the team. When they went to state in 1941-42, he was a freshman. He was definitely a role player, but they needed all nine players.
He was the sixth man on the team. He was a sophomore in high school, and it was interesting, some of the stories that he would tell me, that he had a nickname, they called him Turkey. And the reason they called him Turkey was because his hands were so big. He could palm a ball in each hand and hold it. The coach nicknamed him Turkey because of that. He had a lot of good memories of being able to come in and fill in as a substitute player and all of the playing time that he received.
The appearance of the team when they came on the floor. Did you notice how they fairly shine? The way Charlie Blake smiles when they call a foul on him. The way Isaac Fox agreed with the referee when they called a close one on him. The way the entire team was ready to help an opponent who fell down. The condition of the team, the way they'd keep moving while the other team was getting a minute's rest. We like to think of the Warriors as our team also. As the season went on, townspeople and fans in the area realized the team was special. Losing only two games along the way, they not only qualified for the state tournament for the first time in Elbow Woods history, but sports writers began to write about them in folk hero terms. By this time, the Warriors were well known in the area and had begun to attract a fan club. They were the stuff dream teams are made of.
The name that was given to them was Dazzling Indian Quint. The media started calling this Dazzling Indian Quint because they're dazzling, They're Indian, and there's five on the floor, and they're doing some amazing things. You combine that with a small gymnasium where a radiator sticks out on the floor. And, you know, it's just a fast evolution of basketball for Elba Woods.
They had inferior equipment. They were not equipped in the football or basketball or anything like the rest of the school, particularly the sneakers. Tattered sneakers, but they won.
Former head basketball coach at Louisiana State University and Minot native Dale Brown.
I remember the one guy passed like he's going to be a softball. He'd go behind his back and then left-handed. They loved the game. They were flashy, and they were the Harlem Globetrotters kind of, but there was a sharing of the ball, and I think that came from the tribal culture. You're talking about the sportsmanship. They follow somebody, they'd raise a hand, they'd pick up somebody from the floor.
A lot of ball handling was done, and it wasn't extremely fancy as you see today, but it was a lot of freestyle type basketball. There was between the legs, bouncing the ball. Passing wasn't out of control or anything, but they were unexpected passes that they received, and that's how they scored some of their points on the big teams that they played.
And in perhaps another area where the team was ahead of its time, the 9-player team consisting of 7 native players and 2 white players never experienced any racial strife.
I think what this team did in becoming the first Native American team to play in a state championship is it went so far to show others, other Native Americans, other non-Native people, in the state and everywhere else, that there's some acceptability, that these walls of racism or walls of misunderstanding or prejudice don't need to be there.
Occasionally we did visit about that and say, hey, Dad, you know, you were kind of a minority living on that reservation. And he says, yeah, he says, we were one of a few white families. And he said, so he says, there would have been some reverse discrimination, but he said he never, ever felt looked down. He never felt that he was snubbed by the natives in any way, shape, or form. In fact, we had great trust in them, and they had trust in us. We never locked our doors. They never locked our doors. We were never concerned about anybody breaking in any way, shape, or form. He had a tremendous amount of respect for the people that he lived with and worked with. The people were always welcoming.
In the first game of the tournament on Thursday, March 19th, Elba Woods barely nosed out the New England Tigers, 29-27. On Friday, the Warriors squeaked past Sacred Heart Academy of Fargo, 29-28. Fouled with only 17 seconds remaining, Sidney Fox stepped up and sank the gift shot that won, 29-28. In 8 tries from the foul line during the game, Sidney Fox made good 7 last night. To these, he added 7 field goals for a total of 21 points. On Saturday, they met the Lakota Raiders for the title game. The gym at Minot High was packed to the rafters with basketball fans, many of them rooting for the Warriors. A sports writer of the time commented that even if offered new tires, no one would give up their seat.
But on the day of the state title game against Lakota, Coach Leon Wall faced a dilemma.
So happened to be the day of the championship game that he did turn 20, and he did abide by the North Dakota High School Activities Association rules, eligibility rules, and sat out the game.
In his memoirs, Coach Wall wrote that well before the state tournament, I received 2 calls from the North Dakota High School Athletics Association calling this, John's age that is, to my attention. I informed them that I knew about his age and the rule that made Johnny ineligible, and that we did not plan on using him. This was a blow to our team, as it left us with only 2 substitutes, since 8 was a traveling squad.
So the coach said, you know, we're a team of integrity and honesty, and as much as it's going to hurt us, we cannot play Johnny Rabbithead. So he was not allowed to play in the championship game.
And in that championship game, one of the Fox brothers fouled out, and it was just a matter of one or two points going to the free throw line and making that free throw. And Alba Woods had led the entire way except for the last minute and 30 seconds, I believe. So that was a change that changed the outcome of the game.
And my Uncle Sidney would say this forever until the day he died. If Johnny had been allowed to play on championship night, they could have played all their players and the two refs, and there's no way they were going to beat us. And they ended up beating Alba Woods by 1 point. With Sidney fouled out, my dad with a severely sprained ankle, and no Johnny Rabbit Head, there's three of your top players, and we lose by 1 point in the final minute of the championship game. Led the whole game and lost in the last minute by a free throw, 1 point.
Sidney Fox wrote a letter to the editor of the McLean County Independent, which read as follows. Dear Mr. Daly, we appreciate your backing us in the state tournament. We tried our best all the way through the tournament. We are happy to get second place. It's almost as good as first.
So they lost the game by 1 point. And the thing that's really, I think, remarkable about it is there were no hard feelings. In fact, Sidney Fox said, well, we are just delighted to come back with second place trophy. I mean, they were totally happy with the second place.
But the 1 point loss in the title game would not be the end of things. Several months later, Coach Wall received a letter from the Lakota superintendent stating that Lakota starter Orland Billings was 20 years old at the time of the championship game and had actually played the whole season as a 20-year-old, meaning they had to forfeit the state championship and their entire season for using an ineligible player.
And so the High School Sports Association commended the school for having been timely and forthright. And of course, it made a difficult decision for everybody to say, okay, now what do we do next?
Immediately after that, it was actually awarded to Alba Woods and said, well, Alba Woods deserves and they will be the champion at that point in time. Now, depending on who you talk to, some complaints came forward in particular about some of the teams that lost to Lakota in the semis and the first night. And their argument, I understand, was being made that why are you making Alba Woods champions when we lost close ones to the same team that used an ineligible player as well? One team out of deliberation follows the rules. The other, and I don't know what the basis is, if it was ignorance or our choice, free will, the other team chooses to play a person that is 20 years old. And hence the controversy.
They did a good job and they were not sure. I mean, there was no hard feelings, I don't think. But you know what I mean? They sort of took it with a grain of salt and figured, well, they did well. But if it got taken away, it got taken away.
And even though given to Alba Woods a year later after the tournament, they made a decision to take the trophy and the title away and make a declaration that there would be no champion in 1942.
It was kind of a way of avoiding having to make a decision. It does only seem fair in retrospect that a team that had fought their way through the other side of the bracket and won all of their games by slim margins competitively wouldn't automatically receive consideration as the default champion.
I remember getting those booklets, and I knew the truth because my dad, because of people telling me what happened in 42. But you'd open up that Class B booklet, and you'd go down and see who won championships since the beginning, and you'd see that 1942, and there'd be a notation in there saying, no championship. And you know what? It's easy to look at it that way, but a lot of people, and seeing that, would say, well, World War II. You know, bombing of Pearl Harbor and December 7th, 1941, you know, when we got into World War II, they must not, you know, had any basketball team and no season, and it must have been interrupted and things changed and no tournament and we were at war. Well, that's not the truth.
It just creates a misperception in the public's eyes if they see that 1942 no championship awarded. Everyone, I think, has assumed for years that that meant that it was because of the war, that there was not a championship played. And that's almost more of a disservice to the players on both sides of the bracket, the second and third and fourth place teams and so forth, to sort of deny that what they did was really pretty significant.
You have 9 players on that team. The 7 tribal members, recognized tribal members on that team, every single one of them became veterans of World War II. And I think that's something that, in discussing Alba Wood's 1942 team, that should never be forgotten.
And you think of the coach that Alba Wood had, Coach Wall. He made the decision not to play his best player because of the rules. So he was ethically really strong, and he was morally strong, and he had really excellent character. And he also taught the young men of that basketball team what it means to follow the rules and be fair. And I think one of the things that came into play is because it was a Native American team, and it was the first Native American team to win the championship in North Dakota. So then, you know, they should have been declared as soon as it was recognized that there was an eligible player.
I'm Matt Olean. You're listening to Prairie Public's new documentary, Basketball, Water, and the Lost City of Elba Woods. The second section of the documentary deals with the building of the Garrison Dam in 1953, which resulted in the loss and flooding out of the town of Elba Woods. In this section, you will also hear Mike Jacobs, who grew up near Elba Woods and later became the editor and publisher of the Grand Forks Herald. As Elba Woods continued to thrive through the 1940s with more talented basketball teams returning to the state tournament, a ticking time bomb signaled an end to a way of life.
Behind this sign lies a story, the story of the greatest land and water development in the world. A story of the role this tremendous dam will play in the overall taming of the Missouri River.
It is a big job. An earthen dam being built across the Missouri on the Big Bend where it turns south toward Bismarck and Mandan. Garrison Dam will be the largest rolled fill earth embankment in the world, with the main purposes of providing flood control, hydroelectric power, irrigation, and recreation.
The straw that broke the camel's back was the Garrison Dam.
But let's go down to the job for a closer look. To build big dams, you need big contractors, and this is no exception.
The pleasant 1950s narration about the building of the Garrison Dam, which in turn created Lake Sakakawea, belies the impact and ruin which came because of it. Elba Woods was in the direct path of the project and would have to be flooded out.
Well, Pick Sloan was a big plan by big thinkers. The Missouri River would often flood, no question about it. The water comes rushing out of the mountains, and if they have too much water, it comes rushing down through the Missouri and the tributaries and so on and overflows its banks. And, you know, whether it's Mandan and Bismarck or, you know, virtually everywhere, including on the reservation, you would see flooding. And through the big communities up and down the Missouri, they decided we want to try to control flooding.
Former North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan.
What we want to do is build a series of main stem dams along the Missouri River that will be able to keep water when we don't have enough and then use it through the storage, or try to retain water when we have too much and try to overcome some of the serious flooding problems on the Missouri. The Native Americans bore the brunt. They were required to bear the cost, but they had precious few benefits from it. And frankly, among other things, you know, that Garrison Dam and diversion project, it flooded the river bottom lands where the best berries and fruits and crops were able to be planted and grown and produced. And so the Native Americans had to move to the highlands, a vastly different environment, different diet and so on. So it imposed significant amounts of costs on the Native Americans who lived there.
Because we had crops, we were self-sustaining. We were able to not depend on the federal government. We were able to grow our own crops, raise our own cattle, you know, eat our own food, live humbly, but very well.
Three Affiliated Tribes Chairman Mark Fox.
The Pick's Loan program that created a series of dams to be built along the Missouri River for a number of purposes, primary for, you know, generating electricity. They claim flood control, but we've all realized that that plan don't always work so well and when it comes to flooding. They did it for a number of reasons, recreation and other things, so they justified it.
Almost every Sunday in summer after the dam was closed, we would drive down a half an hour drive, maybe a little bit more, to watch the water come up in places that he remembered. When the water got to Elbow Woods, it was a place that he very much wanted to see and to remember. He'd spent time there as a boy and as a young man and really even as an adult and the father of my older siblings. So we would drive down most Sunday afternoons and essentially watch the water creep into the town.
Mike Jacobs grew up near Elbow Woods and is the former editor of the Grand Forks Herald.
It took almost a year before the water actually got to Elbow Woods, and then it didn't rise all of a sudden. It wasn't, you know, it was a slow flood. So you could live comfortably in the town while there was water coming up in the streets and the low places. So people didn't leave until they had to. And I think there was a sense that what they were going to was nowhere nearly as good as what Elbow Woods was.
It was difficult for my grandparents who raised me. We stayed down Elbow Woods, kind of not on the hill, but on the flat. And then there was a little layer here where we had a lot of log houses around, you know. And that last year in the spring, the water started coming up. So, and people start moving out higher up the other, the land and stuff like that, you know. And we had, we stayed there until there was a little house up in Elbow behind a grocery store. We moved from there into that house.
It was not as pronounced to me then as after I met people in the Indian community from there later on in life. And here are the pain and the anguish and the fear and how the con job they got, what they were supposed to get, they didn't get. I remember driving when the water was coming up. I can remember seeing that and thought, where are they going to go? What are they going to do? How are they going to, be in tent cities or what? And how would we feel if all of a sudden they're coming in flooding our homes? And as you mentioned, the project's never finished. How many millions or billions did that cost?
Our family had pigs, they had livestock, they had chickens. And one way we found out of when they moved, the allotment movement, we have a receipt of everything that was moved of our grandparents. And the government paid them to move. So when our dad went to college, in 1950-51 and played football, he came back to help the move. And when you think about that and all those young athletes, when they played at Elbow Woods, it was a dynasty for basketball. And they went to the state tournament, I believe 6 times out of the 17 years they were there. And then they get drafted and they go off to war and they come back. And they come back to where their land is being taken away, their homes are being taken away, their livelihood is being taken from them, and it must have been a feeling of betrayal.
Dad always insisted it was the best farmland in North Dakota, and he wasn't exempting the Red River Valley. You know, I don't know that that would be scientifically the case, but yes, it was good farmland. And of course, the tribes can speak for themselves, but you know, these were agricultural people. They knew about growing stuff. The agricultural base was taken away.
It shattered familiarity, and that's basically what human nature is about. And when you leave something, there's emotions that are involved. There's the process of facing up to it or denying it. It's painful. Or you go and then you face yourself individually, and I'm sure all of them did individually. And it was a new beginning, but yet the familiarity of the lifestyle and the culture was being given up. So it was an unknown journey to begin with.
And a lot of people were affected by that psychologically. There are no shortcuts to healing. There's just the process of going through the hurt, the recognition of it, the digesting of what takes place, and then trying to put it in its proper place in your lifetime. So that's kind of like what took place with the Garrison Dam.
Dad had some heartbreak over that because his home was gone. I remember him telling me going back there to an Elba Woods reunion and a family reunion, and they got out on a boat and they went over the top of Lake Sakakawea there and found where the homestead where Elba Woods was. And he says, you could look down there, the water was clear. And he says, you could see some of the town landmarks. So I look at the Southwest Water Pipeline Project. I look at the Northwest Area Water Supply Project. I look at the Western Area Water Supply Project. That is what has really kept people in these rural areas. So from that perspective, it was good. From the perspective of the fact that the best bottom land in the world, and I might be probably embellishing it when I say in the world, but that's now underwater, never to be used in a cultivation state so that we can produce food for the world.
You lose not only your home, you lose not only your ability to raise crops, you lose not only a school system that was now thriving, that had a great reputation and was on the map, as my uncle would say. But if you think about it, where you have to go and dig up your relatives, those that you can get to, and rebury them on high grounds, the emotional and spiritual impacts to our people was very devastating.
Garrison Dam will make the Big Muddy really settle down and go to work. It's all a part of the big job.
By 1953, the dam was ready to be dedicated, and families had been relocated, and a new town, called ironically Newtown, was built as a new center of the reservation, and a town where former Elba Woods area residents could settle.
To be honest with you, as the leader of our nation, we've been in a recovery mode ever since that time. And we've been trying to build out of what was done to us beyond our control. What was done to us beyond our choice. We didn't agree to it. We didn't want it. There was at that time politically a conflict of factions that said, one said, keep fighting. The other said, we're not going to win. Let's make hay of what we can get and try to survive through this. And it was very controversial and very intense time to accept this happening.
I was in the last graduating class out of Elba Woods. I was 16 when I graduated. And the year that President Eisenhower came to close the gates and officially declare the Garrison Dam operational was on June 11, 1953, the day that I turned 17. So that's how I remember that date so well. And in fact, a delegation from Elba Woods of veterans went to meet President Eisenhower, because he was a World War II hero. He helped win the war.
It made sense in the context of the time. It does not make sense in the context of today. It would, you know, if such a thing were proposed today, it wouldn't happen. But partly it's because this did happen, and it didn't work. The whole garrison diversion dream turned out not to be viable.
The Rolled Earth Dam under construction near Garrison, North Dakota, is one of the key structures of the Pick Sloan plan of 105 dams.
Well, the Garrison Diversion Plan was a plan that was part of that big Pick Sloan plan. On this main stem dam, the Garrison Dam, the issue was a diversion, and the diversion was for irrigation, but also to divert water when there was too much and keep it and store it when there was too little and control flooding. So I think it's safe to say the benefits from it were real in terms of helping resolve the flooding from this untamed river. That's one thing. Second, The money that the state received in order to build water projects all across the state, rural water projects, that money came from money that I and others put in the appropriations process in order to just force the federal government to live up to its promise, because we didn't get the 1+ million acres of irrigation. That just didn't happen. Why wasn't it finished? Why wasn't it completed as promised? A very big water project like that becomes controversial in Congress. The environmentalists became very, very upset about something called the Lone Tree Reservoir, which kind of became the hood ornament on this project. And so the issue of moving water from the Missouri to the Red when it was necessary, if the Red would run dry, that didn't happen. The irrigation that was promised, that didn't happen.
I encourage all North Dakotans and visitors that come to North Dakota, really look deep into that history of that lake.
Executive Director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, Scott Davis.
As beautiful as it is and the scenery and the recreation that goes in and out of that lake, there's a deeper story. You know, there's a deep spirit within that lake.
Was Garrison Diversion successful? In part because it succeeded in taming that river where we didn't have these unbelievable floods that came and visited our state for some time. But much of it that was promised was not something that was experienced by our state. The costs, however, were experienced by Native Americans living on the three affiliated tribes reservation.
You've seen the picture of the tribal council and the weeping. I think that speaks pretty powerfully.
I'm Matt Olean. You're listening to Prairie Public's new documentary, Basketball, Water, and the Lost City of Elbowoods. The final section of the documentary deals with the efforts by Mark Fox and others at the three affiliated tribes to finally recognize Elbowoods as the official 1942 state champion. In this section, you will hear from former North Dakota High School Activities Association Executive Secretary Sherm Silling and others. In the years after Garrison Dam was built, the memories of the little town underneath Lake Sakakawea began to fade, but there was still one more piece of business left unfinished, the 1942 title and who it really belonged to.
The State Class B program, if you look in the back, it would say it'd have a question mark in 1942.
In the 1990s, my uncle, Sidney, was really heavily involved. I myself was in college. I came back and I got really busy with my career. So it was mainly Sidney. And he was going about and doing interviews. And he had asked the high school board, you know, talk to media. He had gone to look for the trophy. It really became his drive to right this wrong. And unfortunately, when he passed away in 1999, His life ended without achieving his dream, which was to bring that title back, rightfully back to Elbowoods.
It affected so many different pieces that they were scared to open it up. And where would you start and where would you stop? I think that was the biggest thing that the board was dealing with. But when they focused on that game, then I believe they did the right thing.
Sherm Silling, former executive secretary of the North Dakota High School Activities Association.
I think initially I met Mark Fox at one of the tournaments. And then if I remember correctly, he came to my office and where we started discussing the real detail of this. And basically, it was my responsibility to set the agenda. And I know it had been brought up before and it had been denied, I think more than once actually, and you know, but Mark made just a fantastic presentation and he had legitimate statements that were made and he basically convinced me in the office at that time that it's the right thing to do.
Around 2001, I began to reach out. I began to talk to people. I even talked to a couple board members on the board and said, you know, what do you think about this? And that's when the invite came and said, well, get your documentation together. You're more than welcome to present to the
High School Activities Association, and that was in January 2002. And myself, along with a friend and also a fellow council member, Austin Gillette, we went to the High School Activities Association board and we made the plea.
Yeah, I think probably the most compelling was, if it happened today, what would you do? And that was a pretty challenging question. And our bylaws answered that. Even though they probably weren't in place then, they could be applied. And that's what the board chose to do. And so I placed him on a future agenda. And then he came to the board meeting and represented Elba Woods. He represented them very well.
It took almost 60 years, but Elba Woods is finally getting some respect in the record books. The North Dakota High School Activities Association approved a motion recognizing Elba Woods as the 1942 State Class B basketball champion at its Saturday meeting, ending nearly six decades of waiting by the squad. The standard today is to recognize the runner-up team, and that's what should be done here, said Mark Fox from the affiliated Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara tribes. The decision was made a long time ago to declare no champion, and that just doesn't seem right to me.
Of course, it wasn't unanimous. There was two or three that said, disagree, and keep it that way. I don't want to overturn something that was done a long time ago. And they had their reason, I presume. But the majority said, yes, it's come time. And Sherm Silling was became a very good friend. Sherm was the executive director, of course, of the association at that time. And he was really a strong advocate of saying, we need resolve here. This is really important. It's important to the state of North Dakota. It's important to your tribal members. It's important to a lot of people. It's important to Class B basketball that they do this right. And we've all been so appreciative of Sherm.
You know, I think it meant the world to him. Very proud people, and they were denied as a result of a rule violation. And I can only imagine, if I was the recipient of that, how I would feel, and they were elated.
Ladies and gentlemen, the North Dakota High School Activities Association has recently declared that the Elba Woods High School basketball team will be officially recognized as the 1942 State Class B champions. And those original Elba Woods Warrior team members or their representatives are with us tonight. And at this time, we'd like to acknowledge them. We have Leon Fox, represented by Gerald Fox. Dwayne Charging, represented by Steve Charging. Harry Grady, represented by Arnold Grady. John Rabbithead, represented by Delvin Rabbithead. Charles Blake, represented by Gordon Blake. Sydney Fox, represented by Lauren Fox. Isaac Ike Fox, represented by Mark Fox. The two living members of that team are also with us tonight. They are Ray Wycombe and Harold Oderman.
When he got the call that they were going to be awarded the title, that was especially uplifting to him, because he says, you know, we worked on this for 6 years and we finally get the title. And he says, I'm a member of a state championship team. There was a lot of excitement for him. And then, of course, Mark Fox and the three affiliated tribes put together an outstanding recognition and celebration for this event.
For me, it was really kind of sad, in a way, because most of the people that The players, the young athletes, had actually passed away. And 60 years later, after you win a state championship and you know that you won it and your community knows, is a long time. It was amazing to hear the crowd in that state tournament in North Dakota. Everybody was cheering in that gym. And so you know that it was finally accepted by the state of North Dakota that they were declared the champions of 1942.
Those athletes in the 1940s and early 50s had children, and they had children. So even though the school's gone, even though everything's flooded out, you see these awesome, that same blood of those Elba Woods players, what we now call the Elba Woods lore, almost everybody that is an enrolled member can trace themselves back to those amazing athletes at Elba Woods High School.
40, so, look at that steal! Clean.
Now it's a bragging right, you know, to that. And the Elwoods was the champion there. And even though they had never won the other years they won, but they still had that championship 1942, you know. So, and to be have a relative on the team was today's, you know, real, I think, good, you know. So we always wish that they could have been here when knowing that, you know, that they were the champions.
I think he would have a sense of pride and that, you know, we accomplished something. My dad and Kenny Brothers, that they would talk about it. And they say they were honest, and while we should have had that title, but they were humble men.
What they would talk about, of course, was many issues, but always, and a little boy sitting there trying to be nosy and listening, they would always at some point in time talk about and say, whatever happened to what happened to Elba Woods? Did they ever get that trophy back? Did they ever acknowledge and recognize that team? And the discussion would be, no, they never did. And then the comments would always be, you know, that's just not fair, that's not right. And they would talk that way all the time. And I would listen as a little boy, and I always remember that it meant so much to these elders and these people talking. And in my own heart, I knew that some way, somehow, that needed to be addressed.
Well, suddenly you have an event like this, and it really brings it back to life, you know. And you just feel that spirit, that very strong spirit, you know, of those players in the room. They were definitely there. And just, most of all, just the joy. You know, the joy behind that was most powerful that I experienced. But boy, credit to those guys who never gave up. Again, what an amazing story. Call it unfortunate, call it cheated out of their title, a technicality, call it whatever you want to call it, but making it right was obviously the right thing to do, and they achieved that.
My one wish is I would have liked to have seen the championship game and all the other games Elba Woods played. That would have been so fun. It's like the Elba Woods team showed us the ability and skill to succeed in sports or in any other area in life we want to pursue. It's similar to what our chairman, Mark Fox, said. We can do what they did. The Elba Woods team was displaying positive role modeling to us without probably even realizing it at the time. They were giving us hope, getting us excited and passionate. We need that, to persevere and not to give up.
I think it's an important story that is really worth telling, and worth telling the whole context of it and the implications of it. It would be a short story. It wouldn't be very interesting for anybody to say, well, you know, title was vacated and nobody was champion, and to realize that you know, good can come of this process, I think, as well, that all of these people have a right to be proud of their contributions, their achievements, the things that they did with their lives, and how that reflects on the families and the communities that they come from.
It was a sense of achievement, you know, for everyone. So students need to understand that there was a place called Elba Woods. Most students today look out at the Lake Sagagawea and they think it was always there. And I've done some work in schools, and I tell students that where I was raised and went to school is under the water out of in the lake, and they don't believe it. all of those things happened at that time and will never, had never happened before, will probably never happen again, because you can't, you know, it's a time that's well past. The credit would go to, you know, Sydney and Ike and John and Charlie and Harry and Leon and Harold and Raymond, you know, for an unusual bunch that happened to be together at that particular time in the history of not only, like I say, the history of Elba Woods, but the history of North Dakota.
They moved from victim to victory. And once you continually have excuses and whatever, and the excuses are valid in many cases, what they do is they shackle you for life. And at that moment, they broke from it.
There's a spiritual portion to this. You know, this isn't just about a town. It's not just about a few homes and a few businesses. It's about the spiritual understanding of where you come from, where you grew up, who you are, where you're headed. I mean, that's so. People forget kind of the spiritual connection. And you can put that you can put that whole town underwater, many, many feet of water on top of it. It can never destroy the spiritual connection people who lived there, or the ancestors of people who lived there and heard the stories about that. That's spiritual.
That's what makes this 42 team more special than just getting on a hardwood floor and playing a game of basketball. With what happened and the history and everything else, the uniqueness and the specialness of this team and those to follow shouldn't be forgotten.
Elba Woods High School, 1942 State Class B champion.
Here are the members of the 1942 state championship basketball team, the Elba Woods Warriors. Their head coach was Leon Wall, born 1914, died 1987. The players include Raymond Wykum, born 1925, died 2013. Dwayne Charging, born 1926, died 1977. Harold Oderman, born 1926, died 2015. Leon Fox, born 1925, died in 1985. Harry Grady, born 1924, died 1979. Charlie Blake, born in 1922, died 1983. Isaac Fox, born 1922, died 1989. John Rabbithead, born 1922, died 1994. And Sidney Fox, born 1924, died in 1999. The documentary was produced, written, and narrated by Matt Olean. Editor and graphics, Kelly Johnson. Additional narration in the newspaper articles by Merrill Pepcorn, videographers Kelly Johnson, Andy Garski, Dave Geck, and Cassie Pierce. Production manager, Barb Gravel. Executive producers, Bob Dambach and Merrill Pepcorn. Funding for basketball, water, and the lost city of Elba Woods was made possible by the three affiliated tribes and by the members of Prairie Public.
Basketball, Water, and the Lost City of Elba Woods, today on Prairie Public Presents. You can see a video version of this documentary produced by Matt Olean at Prairie Public on YouTube or at pbs.org or using the PBS video app. You may also buy a DVD version of it at the prairiepublic.org shop site. I'm Bill Thomas. This has been Prairie Public Presents. Stick around for some wonderful music programming. You are listening to Prairie Public.